Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. Joining me today, I'm delighted to have Jesper Kohl, a real expert in Japan. Japan is something that has holds a special place in my heart. I spent many happy years in Japan back in the late 80s, early 90s, and developed a real affinity for the country. And obviously, since then, it's been going through a hell of a hard time, and it's fallen off the radars of most investors around the world, except those charged with specifically putting capital to work in Japan. But in the meantime, there's been a very quiet revolution taking place, and I've found myself, when I've sat down to write my monthly Things That Make You Go Hmm letter in the last year, I always sit down every month and write about the thing that has been interesting me the most in the period leading up to that writing week. And I've found that Japan has taken up about one in four letters that I've written in the last year, so that tells me something's going on. So I'm delighted to have the chance to talk with a real expert, Jesper Kohl. He's been living in Japan since the mid-1980s. He was the chief strategist and head of research for JP Morgan and Merrill Lynch at various times, and also a senior advisor to Wisdom Tree Investments in Japan. He's also extremely well-connected in policy circles and an all-around good fellow. So without any further ado, please, I hope you enjoy my very interesting conversation with Jesper Kohl. Well, Jesper, welcome to the podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you after kind of dancing around for such a long time. Thanks for making the time to talk to me.
Thank you for having me. It's a great honor.
Japan is a place very near and dear to my heart. You know, we were talking before we started recording. You know, I had some wonderful years there. It was a lifetime ago, but it's a place that really left an impression on me. And it's a place that I've loved from afar for a long time. And I've kind of bought into the Western narrative about Japan. I thought, oh, what a shame. It's finished. It's over. And the last time I went there, I was struck by how the entirety of Tokyo, as far as I could figure out, had been razed to the ground and rebuilt. And so there's obviously an awful lot more going on in Japan than perhaps people in the West think. So what I'd love to do, now that we have someone there, is to give people a sense of your background, your story in Japan, and then I'd love to talk about the reality on the ground in Japan these last couple of decades before we talk about how things might change going forward. So if you wouldn't mind, if you can weave your story into the reality on Japan the last 20 years, that would be fantastic.
I've been stuck in Japan since 1986, and I came as an unsuspecting PhD student and was lucky enough that I was sent to Kyoto, spent the first year there basically learning the language. And then I got involved in Japanese politics at first. I got a job as an aide to a member of parliament who actually ended up becoming prime minister, Mr. Koizumi. And then I entered the wonderful world of finance here in Japan right at the peak of the bubble. It was actually, I joined in May 1989, the great house of S.G. Warburg from England, when the Brits were great.
Yes, right.
And you know, it was actually the time when the Bank of Japan started increasing interest rates. Of course, that was the beginning then of the end of the bubble economy. But it's quite amazing because, yes, the Japanese stock market collapsed from just around 40,000 all the way down to about 8,000 at one point. Yes, you had zero interest rates for a long, long time. Yes, you had this massive yen appreciation. But the quality of life in Tokyo and actually around the country has actually continued to improve. And you can see that actually. I mean, one silly indicator is sort of the fact that when you look at the sales of Bentleys and Lamborghinis, Tokyo continues to be in the top rankings and continue to be in the top rankings even during the so-called Great Depression here. You talk about buildings. It's quite amazing because even in the sort of mid-1980s, Tokyo already had by far the best public transportation subway system in the rest of the world. Well, since then, they've actually built an additional two subway lines. They have taken the ring road basically underground. So it's now a tunnel system. The building, the skyline of Tokyo, you won't be able to recognize. I mean, the data is amazing. I mean, every year, the equivalent of about 11 to 12% of the grade A office stock comes onto the market here, because basically every building is being scrapped and rebuilt slightly taller, way more architecturally pleasing. About every 20 years, buildings are being rebuilt here. And so, you know, people forget, yes, of course, Japan didn't perform in GDP terms, but in terms of quality of life, in terms of investing in public infrastructure, and ultimately in terms of the public and social and political adjustment, Japan has gone through a real rejuvenation. This was not a lost decade or lost generation. This was really a kaizen, incremental change, step-by-step improvement. The Japanese have completely reinvented themselves, and there's an ambitious reimagination that's going on now.
It's fascinating because the image of Japan from here in the West was very much the things people focused on were the terrible demographics, obviously. That was one reason why Japan's fate was sealed. And again, this difficulty because of, I guess, a lot of the monetary policy going on there, there was a very difficult for people to invest money in Japan. They didn't really feel that they were going to get a return. Everybody has ended up short the yen because of the carry trade. So everybody has a natural short in Japan. And there's just been this sense that money sent to Japan was dead money. And I think, you know, when you look at the chart of the Nikkei and the topics, you know, you see these kind of false dawns. And God knows, I believed in the first probably dozen of them after the 89 bubble burst. And then you kind of just get fatigued and think, you know, it's never going to come back. But very slowly, very quietly, it seems to be doing that. So give us a sense on the ground from an investment point of view, the reality of money going into Japan, capital flows, what's been happening with overseas investment, if any, and what the Japanese have been doing domestically.
Sort of two primary points, right? And I mean, the first one is that Japan is a very high volatility market, right? And, you know, empirically, if you step back, the reason for that is that still about two-thirds of all the earnings for listed companies are generated from the rest of the world, either through offshore production or through outright exports. And so as a result of that, the gearing into the exchange rate and the gearing into global economic growth is just very, very high. It's just literally Toyota has not really made money selling a car in Japan for the last 30 years. They make all their money by selling their cars overseas. And so, you know, I think one of the aversion that global investors have had about Japan is just a hard-nosed analysis and say, well, fine, if all the earnings are being generated overseas, right, there's very little endogenous domestic profit growth or earnings growth, then, you know, yes, it's a cyclical play on the global business cycle, but you can do that by going long stocks in Asia, by going long stocks in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the lack of an endogenous domestic force was really the biggest constraint that Japan ultimately had. The other element, and this is where it gets interesting, is that Japan's balance sheets, if you look at the operational efficiency, generally it tends to be very, very good. But of course, Japan had terribly lazy balance sheets. We started out after the collapse of the bubble. There was, of course, all these non-performing loans at the household sector, and particularly at the corporate sector and financial sector, way too much leverage that needed to be paid down. And, you know, as you know, my friend Richard Koo got this wonderful term, the balance sheet recession. You know, and for all intents and purposes, my God, the corporate Japan paid back almost 100% of GDP worth of debt between 1995 and 2005. And that obviously sort of reduces the corporate mojo to do anything exciting there. And so the interesting thing now is that now I don't have debt on the balance sheet. In fact, the corporate sector is net cash, as you know. The balance sheets are very lazy because the corporate sector has these enormous amount of retained earnings and cash holdings. They're almost 100% of GDP, while the rest of the G7 typically has got about, you know, 35, 40% of GDP of cash. So I've got great operational efficiency, lazy balance sheets, And the reason you should be excited about Japan is now there is pressure from all sorts of sides to actually reduce the lazy balance sheets, to invest in future businesses, to improve capital returns. And that pressure is coming, of course, from the foreigners. But much more important is that you've got the Tokyo Stock Exchange. You've got the Tokyo Stock Exchange basically since April looking you in the eye and saying, hey, if your share price trades below book value, we're going to shame you. We're going to publicly question whether you should stay a listed company. And so everybody goes, oh, my God, because you and I as finance guys, we can do all these wonderful rational calculations. But at the end of the day, it's the social construct. What are you running a company for? What is your role in society? Don't be glib about talking multi-stakeholder capitalism, but actually incorporate shareholders as part of your corporate strategy. And this is interesting because the pressure to generate higher return. Again, you mentioned the demographics. I often joke, the reason I've stayed in Japan is because everybody else gets older faster than I do.
Right.
You know, but look, I mean, the reality is amazing, right? I mean, you know, the average age is now 50, 50. One in four Japanese is basically over 70 now. And as a result of that, of course, society doesn't move as fast as it did before. I always point out that 9 years ago, there was a public decree to cut the speed of all public escalators and electric walkways. So when you come in from Shanghai, when you come in from Hong Kong, when you come in from the Asian cities, the Asian visitors always complain, oh my God, you know, the escalators are so slow. It's like, well, yes, I've got an old society, so it's a dangerous machine.
Right. Yeah. But let's stay on that for a minute, because again, you know, this idea has been a pejorative one in the minds of a lot of investors because Japan's just getting old. So what's the point? But, you know, when you talk about the improvements in corporate Japan, we've seen that in buybacks. We've seen that in dividends. We've seen Japanese companies returning cash to shareholders. They've unwound a lot of the keiretsu. They've unwound a lot of the cross holdings of shares. So there has been this sea change that's really actually quite extraordinary. When you know anything about Japan back in the day, if you took a snapshot in the mid-90s and you took a snapshot today, it would be almost unrecognizable, the Japanese corporate culture. So talk a little bit about how that's happened so under the radar, because when I talk to people about it, they're all bewildered. They say, well, no, that can't be right. I mean, Japan has just always been the same and it's never going to change.
The interesting thing is, I mean, Japan doesn't have any superstars, right? You do not find a Japanese CEO on CNN or somewhere sort of saying...
Masa-san, it may be the exception, I guess.
Yeah, but that's right. I mean, you've got obviously, you know, Masayoshi-san, you've got obviously Yanai-san, you know, who both of them, I mean, they happen to be the richest people in Japan here. And so they play the expectation, they play the charisma game extremely well, you know, but this is not the Keidanren. I mean, you know, the Keidanren is the association of large corporations here, and the CEO changes every 3 or 4 years, right? It's a little bit bureaucratic in a way, but that doesn't mean that stuff doesn't get done. It's very interesting. When I visit companies and you ask companies, what are you running the company for? And what you find out very quickly is that most of the CEOs are actually engineers. And they actually want to build the best air conditioning system. They want to build the best car. Finance is sort of an add-on to them. And they've made their career by sort of creating this perfection. Now, you ask about the little improvements that have happened. And look, the reality in Japan over the last 30 years, I've had zero sales growth. Sales for listed companies, basically until the beginning of this year, have been flat for 30 years. Despite that, earnings went up 11 times. So that tells you that lowering break-even points, right? Improving step by step by step, your supply chain, your vendor system, et cetera, nothing with great fanfare, but over 30 years, the dividends actually pay off. And that's the world that we're in right now. It used to be that in the 1980s, corporate Japan needed sales growth of around 2.5% to generate profits. Now, on minuscule sales growth, you've got very high operational profitability.
And how have they managed to achieve that? Is it just simply that, just cutting corners, cutting edges, cutting expenses out?
It's very interesting. I mean, in 1995, that was the big year of change here. That was the year, you recall, in January, we had the Kobe earthquake. Kobe at the time was the world's third largest container port, and that was taken out. So that's a real disruption. Then in March, we had this domestic terrorist attack. Local cult tried to poison
the
elite bureaucracy there. And then in June 1995, we had the Jusen run on the banks, right? So there was a real banking crisis. And so what happened is that Prime Minister Hashimoto at the time actually made some very radical changes. They had the big bang in finance, which ended up in merging. Remember, I had 21 money center banks, and they ended up being merged into three units. Number two, I had administrative reform, where the financial regulator, which was dispersed, some of it sitting in the Ministry of Finance, some of it at the Bank of Japan, some of it at METI, was merged into one unified financial supervisory agency, the FSA. And then on top of administrative reform and financial reform, we had labor market reform. And that's where the cost cutting comes in. It was the death of the salary man. It was the death of lifetime employment, because all of a sudden, all industries were allowed to hire people on a part-time or contract basis. And when you hire a part-time or a contractor, that's basically a 30% cost saving for the company. And so as a result of that, we saw the only net hirings were part-time employees, not full-time employees, 30% lower disposable income. And that, of course, was one of the reasons why consumption was so very weak over the last 20 years. But in terms of the cost structure, your intake of new employees was all 30% cheaper part-time employees. And then slowly but surely, the expensive Mick Jagger generation, the baby boom generation, started to roll off the payroll. So you had this barbell of attrition as the expensive baby boomers moved towards retirement, plus the new employees hired being 30% cheaper. That's really where the bulk of the lowering of the operational efficiencies, or the improvement in the operational efficiencies, came from.
Give us a sense of life in Japan during that period, because obviously, you know, this happened, where are we? Almost 30 years ago now, you're talking about these big changes being made. And yet, again, as I keep coming back to it, here in the West, that's not been reflected in the news flow. It's not been reflected in the understanding of Japan. Now, Japan specialists will disagree with me, and that's absolutely fine. I understand that. But the general kind of awareness of Japan is almost zero. It's extraordinary. So I think that's because we've seen the drumbeat of deflation. We've seen the desperation of the Bank of Japan. We've seen the widowmaker trade has become very, very well understood. And so we've just seen all these negatives build up. But give us a sense of life on the ground living in Japan during this 20-year awful period of deflation and misery and, you know, all the things that we believe here in the West it to have been.
It wasn't awful at all. And I do want to point out that obviously, you know, since the mid-1990s, there was a new sexy thing. The People's Republic of China was on fire. America was on fire. And both America and China were working very, very hard to ensure that, you know, at that point, China was going to be integrated into the global economy. You know, and meanwhile, here's Japan, which suffered a tremendous hangover after the collapse of the bubble, and getting out of a hangover by steadfast gradualism improvement is a very, very interesting story. But, you know, in terms of your time risk reward, yes, you'll make money in the long term from this restructuring. But in the meantime, you know, China is growing 12% and America is inventing the internet. You know, so there was this incrementalism, steadfast performance, always a little bit boring, certainly in the life of finance. But you asked on the ground, it was absolutely fascinating because there was obviously a huge battle inside the Kremlin. Remember that the most successful political party in the world, the LDP, lost power. Every 15 months, we had a new minister of finance. So there was obviously hardship, and there was an enormous amount of regime uncertainty and this change in society. Oh my God, you have lifetime employment. Now, oh my God, no, there is no lifetime employment. It's all part-time and contract work. This is a huge fundamental change in society. Yet despite all of that, unemployment never really went above 6%. And the trains kept on running on time, and the streets were clean. And as I said, investment in public infrastructure, whether it is subway systems, whether it's roads, I mean, the internet. You know, Japan, if you look at the pipes and sewers of the internet, Japan, according to engineers who do this for a living, Japan has the most robust, internet infrastructure in the world. And then the other thing that's very interesting that people always forget is, you know, yes, there was this deflation. Yes, there was zero interest rates. Yes, there was a lot of debt repayment, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, in macroeconomic terms, Japan never lost its status as the world's largest creditor country. So it's quite incredible. And you can obviously see that by the realities of massive foreign direct investment by Japanese companies. You find that offshore production, basically in the early 90s, accounted for about 11, 12% of total productive capacity. Now it's about 50%. Enormous change that has happened there. So there was investment for growth. It wasn't in Japan, just as global investors didn't believe in the Japan domestic stories, just as global investors believed that there were better growth opportunities outside of Japan, corporate leaders did exactly the same thing, and they invested in the People's Republic of China, they invested in Indonesia, they invested in India, they invested, of course, in the United States to optimize and to become really global players, right?
Yeah, no, it is remarkable, the transformation. But what's been the attitude when you've spoken to domestic investors and also foreign investors? When you talk to them about investing in Japan, how have the two mindsets differed and how have they changed, particularly over the last 4 or 5 years?
I think over the last 4 or 5 years, the single biggest change has been that global investors are realizing, number one, that there is value. And number two, that there are concrete ways to actually escape the value trap. And this is where activism and engagement investment comes in. Because 10 years ago, when sort of the initial activist campaigns were run, you were immediately ousted from the club. You know, you're persona non grata. This is not the way business is done in Japan. Now it has become accepted, and running an activist campaign against the corporation, now it's like America in a way. It gets noticed, right? You know, but, you know, it is not going to be criticized in the Japanese media. It's not going to be criticized by Japanese politicians. And that's the interesting thing, to come back to how the conversation has changed over the last 4 or 5 years in particular, is the realization that, okay, the peer pressure, the domestic will to actually raise capital returns has actually changed. And that's where it's the GPIF, the Japanese Government National Pension Fund, that is actively holding its investors' feet to the fire. What are you doing about capital returns? What are you doing about dividend policy? What are you doing about cross shareholdings? It's not the black sheep from overseas, but it's the domestic community, you know, that is actually putting the pressure to the feet. And from that perspective, then, you know, you get lucky. It'd be wrong to deny the fact that when Warren Buffett years ago came in to buy a significant stake in the five trading companies, the Tsubo Shosha, you know, that obviously raises the highlight as well. And so I think it's the reality that this time around, the change is endogenous. It is actually the Japanese themselves who want higher rates of return. They're no longer playing defense. They're actually starting to play offense in terms of wanting both operational efficiency as well as capital efficiency.
This idea of wanting higher returns, I guess, naturally brings us to the Bank of Japan, which has been such a central figure in the narrative around Japan, particularly here overseas, for so long now. You know, you can't, I mean, it has been impossible to talk about Japan as a market without the conversation devolving into a discussion around the Bank of Japan. So give us a sense of how the Bank of Japan is viewed domestically in terms of their policies, what they've done, whether people think they've handled it well or handled it poorly, and also a sense of domestically whether people think the Bank of Japan is stuck or they feel that real change is about to happen and the Bank of Japan is going to be able to normalize, as the phrase they've been trying to use.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that, because that was one of the reasons why I enjoyed being in Japan for the last 30 years. I'm living a liquidity trap. And by the way, we've had zero interest rates, not for a couple of quarters, but for one generation. And I remember going for drinks with Governor Kuroda in the week before he got appointed. And he was saying, my God, you know, so Kuroda-san, how does it feel? And he said, well, I'm actually quite scared, because I'm becoming the central banker to a banking world where no banker has made a loan in one generation. Monetary policy at extreme, you know, is obviously where Japan came in, with this wonderful paradox that despite nominal interest rates being so low, despite quantitative easing and all of that stuff, the yen structurally during the time was an appreciating currency. So the transmission mechanism, not just the credit channel, not just the wealth channel, but also the exchange channel were very blocked. And I think in terms of your question, it's important to recognize that in 2011, was another big crisis moment. I mentioned the first one, 1995. The second big crisis moment was 2011, which of course was the Fukushima disaster. But what the Fukushima disaster outlined was administrative incompetence, in the sense of that you don't want to wish this on your worst enemy, what happened in Fukushima. I mean, let's just be very clear, it's a huge tragedy. But in terms of, oh my God, the public recognition that we need stronger leadership, we need more radical solution, this Kaizen approach is not going to work anymore. And that, of course, got us Prime Minister Abe to come back. And then very quickly, Abe was elected, as you remember, national election in December 2012. And then in March 2013, we got the Bank of Japan Governor Kuroda. And Governor Kuroda, you remember his first press conference, he had this wonderful chart. And he basically said, like, anything goes. We will do whatever it takes. And he then, of course, did his various bazookas and was very radical change. At the time, there were, of course, skeptics, but those skeptics were very quickly overruled by the reality that Japan was in deep, deep crisis. And what he did unlock with this promise on, look, watch me, I'm going to do more. If you think you know what I'm going to doing, I'm going to do double that and surprise you. And as you know, the ultimate transmission mechanism that he unlocked was the exchange rate, because the yen started to depreciate. And as a result of that, the terms of trade began to change. As a result of that, the end of deflation, certainly in asset prices, started to come through. And he got the Nikkei. When he took over, the Nikkei was basically at around, I forget, 11, 12,000, something like that. And as you know, the Nikkei basically more than doubled during the time of his tenure. So unlocking the exchange rate channel and unlocking the asset channel was really very, very important.
But to do that, the Bank of Japan essentially had to corner the government bond market.
And now you're wandering into, as you know, I'm from Germany, and I'm going to have to become slightly un-German. in the sense of, here in Japan, we're running the largest monetary fiscal policy experiment that we've seen in world history, right? I mean, the Bank of Japan owning slightly more than half of government debt now, and the Bank of Japan continuing, for all intents and purposes, with the new regime, to actually add to that position, while at the same time, and this is really a big change, the Ministry of Finance has lost its grip. I was always joking with some of the macro investing is always fun, because when you visit policymakers, there were always two institutions where you had to sharpen up. You would put on your tie and, you know, your extra good suit. And those two institutions were the Bundesbank and the Ministry of Finance, because you knew you entered the Ministry of Finance, you would get a lecture on fiscal rectitude and all of that wonderful stuff. Now, when I go to the Ministry of Finance from about 2 years ago, you know, they basically, we're running another deficit of 4% of GDP. And it's like, yeah, you know, the BOJ will take care of it. So it's very interesting that that sort of compass from the Ministry of Finance, this focus on fiscal discipline, has actually gone out. And in a way, as a macro analyst and as a macro investor, that certainly is the potential weak spot that Japan has. Now, We've seen record increases in tax revenue collection. Again, over the last 20 years, indirect taxes have been increased. Some of the porousness in the direct taxation system has been closed down. So there's actually very, very good tax multipliers now. But having said that, we've had one of the largest recoveries in terms of nominal national income growth, but we're still running fiscal deficits of around 4% of GDP. So on the fiscal side, yes, there is excess savings relative to the public appetite for new debt. However, I don't think you can find a single economist who can actually solve Japan's fiscal deficit problem.
Right, right. That's exactly right. And that may be the problem. We're hoping for like a deus ex machina to come and solve this for them. But it does bring us to this point about the way out for Japan, because obviously the Bank of Japan has been kind of floating the N-word recently in terms of normalization. And I'd like to get a sense of what they mean by that, because I think, again, to the West, they're so far away from anything that would resemble normal. You kind of wonder what they mean, but what do they mean by normalization, do you think?
I think it's very, very simple. And first and foremost, I think it is very clear that over the last year and a half, unlike the United States and Europe, Japan did not need demand destruction. The last thing I need, because I mean, yes, the stock market is doing well, thank you, but the aggregate economy, God, you know, it was all cost push inflation through the terms of trade. It's not demand pull inflation. So I think Japan is different from certainly the United States of America and Europe, right? In the sense of that there was no fire, there was no inflationary fire that you need to put out by aggressively stepping on the monetary brake. So Ueda has always been very clear that he views the risk is asymmetric, that the risk of a fallback into deflation is higher than the risk of runaway inflation. Now, normalization. Over the last couple of weeks, the rhetoric has changed there. And by the way, in terms of a forecast, I actually think that this time next year, the policy rate will be at 0.5%. I think it's very, very clear that short-term interest rates very, very gradually, maybe in 10 or 15 basis points increments, are going to be normalized there. And they've done a fantastic job. When you think about it, basically a year ago, they increased the cap on the 10-year bond yield, and they allowed the bond market to begin to reliquify. The bond market was dominated by the Bank of Japan. The private sector players were basically playing golf all day. Now the bond market has actually reliquified. The Bank of Japan has actually taken away the hard cap, and it's now a reference rate, the 1% rate. But if you look at the liquidity in the bond market, basically the private players have started to come back. And then for 2024, we're going to see the reliquification of the short-term money markets. And I think, again, the Bank of Japan being very, very gradual, not designed to destroy demand, but designed to reliquify domestic money markets, that's very incremental steps that are going to be taken.
Well, it's fascinating because this idea that the policy rate might get to 50 basis points in a year, it sounds so trivial, and yet the change that that would signify is enormous. It's a seismic shift, not just for Japan, but for capital flows all the way around the world. Because one has to imagine that if we picture a world where the Bank of Japan's policy rate is 50 basis points, I would imagine there's going to be an awful lot of capital coming back to Japan. And that's going to have a big difference to a lot of people around the world. And particularly given the recent weakness in the yen, one's got to imagine the yen has an awful long way to strengthen from here.
It's very interesting. Look, I completely agree with you. Let me start by a more real problem outside of money markets, which is the reality that the mortgage market here has changed completely. It used to be dominated by fixed rate mortgages. Now, 80% of the outstanding mortgages are actually floating rates, right? And you can show that if mortgage rates, so for short rates, right, if mortgage rates were to go up by 100 basis points, wages would have to grow by about 16% for affordability to actually stay the same. The big debtor, obviously, is the Ministry of Finance. What's interesting, by the way, about the Ministry of Finance, that they've started to publish papers from about a year ago, basically on their calculations, they say that we can do with an average funding cost of 1.6% rather than the 0.4% that they've had over the last couple of years. So the MOF is actually already signaling that according to their strategies, they're okay with interest rates actually going higher. The negative impact on the household sector via mortgages is going to be very, very interesting. And that's where we have this circular argument, oh, wages need to go up. And once wages go up, then we know that there is more sustainable demand, et cetera, et cetera. But that applies in the financial world as well, in the sense that if I do have to refinance my floating rates into higher rates, that becomes a burden that you need to watch out for very carefully.
How do the Bank of Japan and the MOF figure this out? This whole cornering the bond market, the balance sheet, only half the market, the MOF, you know, there's been an awful lot of talk about they just kind of write those off and exchange a note between them, a perpetual at zero, and they just run the thing and literally liquidate the whole thing and pass it off. One would imagine that wouldn't be too constructive for the currency. But I've kicked this around a lot with my friend Bill Fleckenstein in many of our podcasts, and we've been trying to figure out how they ease out of this position they're in where they do own such an outsized portion of Japanese government debt. Have you given that much thought over the years? I mean, I'm sure you must have done. I'd love to know your ruminations.
The answer is very simple. Probably the most famous attribute of Japanese culture is the word gaman. You just stick it out. It's not that you pretend that it's not there. It's obviously there on the balance sheet. But, you know, what you do is you basically don't mark to market and you just hold and then you roll into the next level. And by the way, these zero perpetuals, I remember when I was at JP Morgan, I mean, this was always the wet dream of every new
exactly
manager
right.
who came in. It's like, oh my God, you know, isn't this obvious, right? et cetera, et cetera. So I think that for all intents and purposes, at the end of the day, it comes down to the reality that domestic asset owners still have a very, very high domestic currency preference. What I'm trying to say is that the risk of capital flight is actually very low. As a result of that, you know, you can run this scheme much longer than if you were in a free capital flow assumption type of model where you're right, the yen should be at 250, 300. There should be all this capital flight that's going on. It's not. Of course, Mr. and Mrs. Watanabe, every once in a while, there's some famous headline in the Financial Times about how some punter is buying half the Australian bond market or something like that. But the reality is that the home currency bias is just extremely high. And so from a policy perspective, this gaman, we're going to tough it out, still stays very, very much on the agenda.
It's fascinating because the progress they've made even this far, even just by raising the cap on the 10-year the way they have, and as you say, turning it into a reference as opposed to a hard cap. When you look at what happened when the Australians did the same thing a few years ago, all hell was let loose once they took their cap off. And given the outsize, the difference in size rate between the Bank of Japan's positions and the RBA's positions, one would have expected, I certainly did, that we would see a much stronger reaction. So look, what the Bank of Japan has been able to do, or maybe what the market has allowed them to do, I really don't know which it is, but there's definitely some nuance between the two. They've gotten a lot further down this road than I thought they would without any kind of dislocation.
And remember, the reason for that is that, of course, I am the world's largest creditor country, and I do have a very strong home currency preference. What I always pointed out to people who want to be massively short JGBs, right, is I said, look, the Japanese insurance and pension market every year fixes the yotei-ritsu. What that is, it's the guaranteed savings rate that you get for a Japanese pension account. And that savings rate is basically fixed at 0.8%. That gets fixed every March of every year. So for next year, if you want to talk bond markets, right, what you really need to watch out for is that what is that yotei-ritsu, right, that guaranteed savings rate, where is it going to be fixed? And so at current bond yields, right, you know, the reference rate is probably going to be around 1%, which means that a 1% 10-year bond It's not infinite, but you will have a significant amount of demand from Japanese pensions and insurance companies actually just matching their liabilities because they want to play golf and clip coupons. So it's quite interesting. This is not a conspiracy theory whatsoever. It's just my liabilities are here in Japan, and if I can match them at a 0.8, 0.9, 1% rate, you will see an incredible amount of demand. And to your point, that of course does mean that liquidity into the Australian bond market, liquidity into the US Treasury market is obviously going to be curtailed.
We're seeing signs of that already, very slow signs, but we're definitely seeing signs of that. So when you look across the landscape now, let's start with the currency, because again, you know, we've seen some kind of half-hearted intervention by the Bank of Japan at 150 and then a bit at 153.4 kind of thing. It was a one-day thing and then they backed off. What do you think is happening with the currency? Was that the Bank of Japan floating trial balloons? Were they trying to send a message and failed? I really couldn't figure out what happened with those interventions.
It's very interesting. I think that is there a pain point? And the interesting thing is that, of course, you know, 150 is a nice round number and people get excited about that, right? But I mean, the pain point is as follows. The average Japanese exporter has a foreign exchange rate assumption of around 135 on their exchange rates. Yen depreciation gives you windfall profits. But if the yen were to appreciate past that point, you would have to revise down your earnings estimates for Japanese companies. The second point is, what about on the downside? Is there a pain point? And the irony is, not really. In the sense of that, yes, if there were an accumulation of capital flight from Japan, that would raise significant flags there. And as a result of that, the Ministry of Finance, the Bank of Japan, you do have to signal, if and when you get these volatility spikes for yen depreciation, you do have to signal that you are concerned. But it's not a hard stop. And the reason it's not a hard stop is that there is no aggregate inflation problem. Yes, I've got gasoline prices, but gasoline prices and other cost push inflation gets dealt with via fiscal policy. Prime Minister Kishida has already done 3 price support measures or income support measures to cushion against those affected by the deterioration in the terms of trade there. I don't think that that's going to go away. Now, what I've learned the hard way of investing in macro here in Japan and investing in dollar yen is that your focus on the Federal Reserve is much, much more important than your focus on the Bank of Japan. And of course, you know, so if and when US unemployment starts to increase consecutively, and indeed rate cuts from the Federal Reserve do actually become a reality, the dollar will become a weaker currency. For 2024, in terms of an outlook, I think you're still better off focusing on the Fed rather than on the Bank of Japan.
So the yen will move as a second order of other central bank policy rather than anything the Bank of Japan does in terms of their normalization. Okay, yeah. All right, that's
Can
interesting.
Can I make one other point, which is something that concerns me, which goes beyond interest rate differentials and Bank of Japan policy? I mean, that's obviously, we agree, interest rate differentials sort of are dominant force. And look, it's interesting because my forecast is for the Bank of Japan to be at 0.5 short rates by this time next year. And yes, it's a significant change from zero, particularly since zero has been around for almost 20 years. But in the absolute scale of things, it's not going to be a lot.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah.
You know, so there is this adjustment which we keep market chatterers, you know, very happy. But I think that the more worrying issue I'm monitoring very carefully is actually Japan's balance of payments. And what you actually see is that Japan's exports are incredibly weak. And when you look at it, it's because exports to the People's Republic of China are very weak. And you can take the lazy approach and lean back and sort of say, ah, that's because Xi Jinping is running the country into the ground. But that's actually not true. When you actually look at the next layer of detail, you actually find that there is starting to be significant substitution, with Chinese corporations now providing the robots, the machinery, the machine tools that up until recently only Japanese companies could provide. Because obviously, you know, if Japan's balance of payments, if the tradable goods exports is actually under in structural decline because of more competitive suppliers from the People's Republic of China, that means that that cushion I had for yen appreciation, which is Japan runs sizable balance of payment surpluses, if that structurally actually gets reduced, then the signals or the warning for potential more structural downward pressure on the Japanese currency becomes actually very real.
I was going to ask you, you know, given all the various false dawns over the years, is there anything apart from that that worries you to think, you know, if they get this part wrong, we could see this fall over again?
It's very simple. I got very angry. I got actually called into the Prime Minister's office. I was on national TV on the day when Prime Minister Kishida gave his policy speech when they opened Parliament in late October. And you may have followed this. He said, we're going to cut taxes and then we're going to hike taxes. And you go like, oh my God, you're a politician. You can hike taxes. You can cut taxes. But you cannot do Boris Johnson and have both. The reason why this is a problem is, number one, whether we like it or not, the sensitivity of Japan to tax increases is just very high. The big recessions, the big downturns we had over the last 20 years were all related to tax increases. It's just the way things are. More importantly, if you end up in a situation where the Bank of Japan is looking to normalize interest rates, and at the same time, you're facing increases in taxation, a double tightening of both monetary and fiscal policy is something that you want to be very, very concerned about.
Right. We've seen in recent quarters, we've seen some surprisingly good results from the banks, which makes a nice change. Give us a sense of which sectors in Japan are kind of the best placed to benefit from the picture that you've laid out over the last hour or so.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. I still love the banks and the financials. You still have got a nice value proposition there. They still trade 0.5, 0.6, 0.7 book. They are going to be beneficiaries from steepening of the money curve. They are going to be a beneficiary from corporate investment, actually, in my opinion, continuing to increase here. So I think that the banks and the financials, including the insurance companies, are a very, very good sector to actually focus on. I think that over and above that, I do like the Japanese capital goods companies. I mentioned that I'm looking very carefully at their global competitiveness with Chinese competitors coming in. But when you look at a company like Daikin, for example, when you look at a company like Kian's, for example, I do think in terms of what the product pipeline that they have and the wherewithal to actually raise their global footprint, I think that the Japanese machinery and machine tool companies, capital goods companies, are going to continue to be very, very good investments, right?
Right. I have to ask you about the trading companies, because obviously anywhere that Warren Buffett goes, as you say, it gets people interested. How do they look now? Obviously, they've had a decent run, and they've always been such powerhouses of a strong Japan. I think of them back in the 80s, they really were a big part of what made Japanese companies so popular around the world. What's the current state of play for the trading companies?
So I will tell you a funny anecdote. I recently gave a talk in front of 1,000 retail investors, and we had a Q&A function there. And one of the comments was, yeah, Warren Buffett is very smart. He bought 2 years ago, and he will sell when I increase my NISA savings account investment. And there's obviously short-term, a little bit of a risk that everybody's so excited about these new NISA equity investment savings accounts that are going to start on January next year, that that's going to be the next demand lead. There's obviously a risk that that's going to be underwhelming relative to very hyped up expectations there. The trading companies themselves, I think that the value proposition has started to sort of come away there. They are very, very geared into global economic growth and global expansion there. And so I think actually, you know, for 2024, I don't expect that they're going to be market leaders, because outside of Japan, I expect that the global economy is going to be weaker, rather than stronger. And so I think for me, it's more like they're more like a market market neutral type of investment here.
So where else should people be looking then? Because it feels, as we've discussed, it feels like Japanese capital will be coming home if the rates scenario plays out as you imagine it will, and I certainly think along the same lines. Where is that domestic capital, do you think, going to be put in the domestic market?
I do think that anything related to real estate, particularly residential development, residential developers, housing companies, I do think that this upgrade of the housing stock, now that the younger generation is getting better jobs, is getting access to credit, is very, very important. So I like the home builder sort of set here, and ultimately some of the real estate development companies, I think, are potentially very, very good plays. Be a little mindful of commercial if you're playing the Japanese REIT market here, but anything that is development and residential, I think, is a very, very high focus here. I do think that on the consumer services side, for example, at the department stores are actually beneficiaries of the increase in land prices. It's just that your book value goes up. But over and above that, when you look at a company like Marui Department Stores, they've got a new CEO who actually wants to do stuff. And again, I'm a firm believer that at the end of the day, particularly with established companies, you do need the management. You know, they change from the top. Another company I am absolutely enthralled in is NTT. NTT is obviously the old telecommunications dinosaur. It is the most unionized company in Japan, but they have a new CEO and he has introduced pay for performance.
Who would have thought in Japan?
Who would have thought? Exactly. You know, so I think, you know, from that perspective, a company like NTT is a potentially very, very rewarding investment.
Yes, but it's been absolutely fascinating. I've thoroughly enjoyed this hour. It's something that I've been focusing more and more on again. And I'm so grateful to you for giving people who aren't as familiar with Japan such a comprehensive tour of both the history and the current. And I'd love to continue this conversation with you, because I just think Japan is going to be, I know it's going to be on my radar screen this coming year, and I suspect it's going to crop up on a lot of other people's radar screens also.
What is interesting, if we can end on that, you've got to get your head around to the fact that the demographics is actually a catalyst to unlock domestic productivity. My friend, who is the head of personnel at Mitsubishi, he has tears in his eyes because he says 6-7 years ago, the students were begging me to get them a job. Now they're sitting in front of me and they're saying, so what are you going to do for me? What is my career going to look like? Can I get fast track promotion? That's where it gets interesting, when you have to break out of the established, arrogant, dare I say, mold of, oh, this is how we've always done business. We're never going to change because we're Japanese. Now, because the labor market has actually turned the tables, it's now a buyer's market. And as a result of that, you start to see the breakdown of seniority-based pay. You get the introduction of pay for performance. Tokyo University, the elite school, Tokyo University graduates now, more than half of the kids don't stay on their first job for more than 4 years.
Really? Wow. That's a sea change, yeah.
But this is where it gets interesting, because again, at the end of the day, where does productivity, where does profits, where does growth, where does it come from? It doesn't come from ChatGPT. It doesn't come from technology. It comes from human capital. And the reality of the change in human capital here now, it's a buyer's market for the young generation, and they are demanding, they're ambitious. And that's, I think, where it gets interesting. And when you've got a dinosaur like NTT introducing pay for performance, then you got to listen, because, hey, that's where you're going to get out of the value trap.
Yeah, you know, that's such an interesting point, because you're right. For anyone who's not familiar with Japanese working practices, it's difficult to understand what a sea change that is. But that really is, that's a remarkable turnaround for a country like Japan.
Yep. Plus, you know, it's still the lifestyle superpower. I was in Germany recently presenting to the German government, and, you know, they told me that, oh my God, 72% of all German trains are now at least 30 minutes late. Well, here in Japan, the cumulative daily delay of the Shinkansen is 3 minutes and 17 seconds.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, yeah, amazing. Well, listen, again, I thank you so much. As I said to you before we came on air, I am determined to get back to Japan this year because it's been too long since I've been there.
Come over, we do a show from here.
I would love to do that. I would love to do that. And I'll buy you a nice dinner to say thank you. So thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Great. Thank you.
Well, there you have it, folks. Hopefully you will see why I've become so enamored all over again with Japan. I think there's a real story emerging here. It's an extraordinary country. They have some remarkable companies there. And as I said, it's fallen off so many investors' lists. And for me, the opportunity just seems to be excellent to take another look at Japan. So if you're not looking at it already, I would encourage you to do so. It's the world's third largest economy. It's a place where you can put real capital to work. And there's a real story there now. So my thanks to Jesper for taking that time to share that story with us. I'll be back with another guest in the not-too-distant future. In the meantime, as always, thank you so much for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.